On June 24th, four acclaimed directors, George Miller, John Landis, Joe Dante, and Steven Spielberg, take you to another dimension.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. Hopefully, if you are listening to this podcast, you really enjoy The Twilight Zone and were able to listen to Samantha Ellis and I talk about our top three favorite episodes of the classic Twilight Zone television series. And we decided we wanted to go one step further and talk about the 1983 attempt to make a big screen adaptation of the series and all the things that went wrong with it. And I'm a big fan of the movie, so I wanted to talk about it, even though it doesn't technically fit into the classic film era. So hopefully you are listening to this because you enjoy The Twilight Zone, or maybe you just accidentally downloaded this by mistake. And if you did, definitely go check out the other episode. But if you are in the right place, hopefully you enjoy our discussion about 1983's Twilight Zone, the movie.
You want to see something really scary?
You bet.
Okay, this is really, really scary now.
I trust you.
Okay, pull the car over.
Pull the car over?
You want to see it?
Well, show me while I'm driving.
No, I can't. I can't tell you about it. It's only take a couple of seconds.
All right, 2 seconds, okay?
Okay.
What is it?
Just pull it over.
Okay.
I'll show you.
All right.
Okay.
Scare me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this special bonus episode. It's been a while since we've done a bonus episode of Ticklish Business. If you are listening to this, then you either really like The Twilight Zone or you accidentally downloaded this by mistake. This is a continuation of a discussion that we did on the previous episode listing our top three favorite Twilight Zone episodes, and we wanted to give you a full overview of our love for The Twilight Zone, and that includes the 1983 movie. Not something we would commonly do on a podcast aimed at doing classic films pre-1970, but again, it's a movie turning 35 this year. It's a film I love. You can't really talk about Rod Serling Twilight Zone and not talk about the movie. The 2002-03 revival does not count. That doesn't exist in this world. So we're talking about the 1983 movie directed by John Landis, Steven Spielberg, Joe Dante, and George Miller. We're going to be breaking it down by each individual vignette, what have you. And I am joined once again by Samantha Ellis. Samantha, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much. Happy to be here once again.
We have already talked about our top three favorite Twilight Zones. We talked about the show and how much we love it. What is your background with the movie? I know most people, I'm going to say it, younger than me, don't know there is a movie.
That's a fair assessment, because I knew of the movie only because my sister is also very interested in Hollywood, the history, but she's very into the dark history and the tragedies and the controversies.
Your sister and I have a lot in common.
Right. So she told me about of course, I'm sure we're going to discuss it, but the very unfortunate accident that occurred on the set of filming John Landis's segment Time Out. And I knew about it in that context, but I had never seen it. I didn't know anything about it or what it was going to be, and it really wasn't even on my radar until you mentioned doing it for this episode, so that was the first time that I saw it.
if you listen to the Twilight Zone episode, our top threes, I talked about seeing the show backwards because I had seen the movie first. I cannot tell you the first time I'd seen this movie. All I know is that when I was a teenager, I remembered snippets of it, and I did not know what it was. And my mom said, "Are you thinking of the Twilight Zone movie?" And I said, "What is this?" And I watched it, and I was like, "Yeah." So I have no idea whether I consumed it as a very young child or whether I had just seen snippets of it on TV, because I was not born when it had came out. But I love this movie. I appreciate this movie and what it tried to do. And I, too, am very consumed. I know way too much about what happened behind the scenes on this film, but I appreciate it anyway. It saddens me that this movie got pretty much maligned and ripped apart, both necessarily and unnecessarily, before it had even come out. Not necessarily the death knell for anthology movies. There were a lot of anthology films. Creepshow had come out the year before. You had Tales from the Dark Side, The Outer Limits attempt to do a movie. So you had a lot of these anthology films leading up to the wake of Tales from the Crypt on HBO. I love that we tried to make anthology movies of old television shows. I wish we did it more often. They're redoing The Twilight Zone next year for CBS All Access with Jordan Peele, and I'm interested to see that, but we haven't really attempted to do it with a film since. This was produced by Steven Spielberg and John Landis, two big fans of the series. It was supposed to be this big, epic movie. It's 1983. You have Steven Spielberg, John Landis, just coming off of American Werewolf in London. So many amazing people associated with this. It was almost too big to fail. Joe Dante, Gremlins had come out. I mean, this was a movie that was poised to be a big deal. And it was just struck down by the most horrific series of events you could imagine. The movie is essentially a remake of three episodes with an original. There's a prologue that bookends the movie. We start with our prologue. It's called Something Scary. You have two men played by Albert Brooks and Dan Aykroyd. They're driving very late at night. They don't know each other. Dan Aykroyd is a hitchhiker who's been picked up by Albert Brooks. They start talking about television shows that they found very scary, and it talks about the Twilight Zone. It's a really basic way of saying this is based on the television show, trying to tie things in. There's really no overarching arc to it. Burgess Meredith does the narration.
No, there's no similarity.
You don't get the Rod Serling voiceover until the end, oddly enough, but have Burgess Meredith doing introductions. But that's really the only callback. So you need something like this to tie things into the series proper. So it's a nice little meta moment where in this world, the Twilight Zone show is a thing. This banter back and forth, they start talking about stuff that scares them. The end, Dan Aykroyd says, "You want to see something really scary?" He tells Albert Brooks to pull the car over, and he turns into this horrific monster and attacks the driver. This is one of the best opening sequences. Somebody's probably gasping right now. There are so many great opening sequences. I think this is one of the best. A, it starts with Creedence Clearwater Revival's Midnight Special. I love how the vignette uses it with the two singing along, and they have little commentary throughout it. The script posits that these two people know each other. You are believing that these characters have some sort of relationship. They're friends going on a road trip, and it's through this natural, organic conversation that you discover that, no, they do not know each other, that Dan Aykroyd is a hitchhiker. And almost immediately, in 83, 93, 2003, 2013, hitchhiker is evil. It's always going to be how it is. The two actors have really good natural chemistry with each other. You almost don't want it to end. At least I don't want it to end, because I think that they both are having a lot of fun. And when Dan Aykroyd says, "You want to see something really scary?" and he says, "Pull the car over," you're just like, nope. Nope, nope, nope. And the look on his face before the transformation, there's a lot of really weird interest in how scary something silly is. And I think that sets it up. It also sets up the fact, the pet peeve I think many people have with this movie, which is that the Twilight Zone was never scary. Even though the characters say it was scary, it was never really scary. This movie makes it really literal monsters, literal horror, which is both good and bad. The prologue does a really great job.
I first want to say that I'm a little bit embarrassed because I didn't know until you just said it that they didn't know each other.
I have watched this movie several times. I know this scene. I actually did in high school. I TA'd for a film class and we had to show the students an example of a scene analysis. I actually picked this. I have deconstructed this very deeply.
The prologue was really funny, and it definitely helped offset the sincerity of the rest of the film with a bit of humor. I feel like if it began with Time Out, it would have been a completely different movie.
You're gonna either be with the movie or against it from the minute that monster shows up.
Absolutely.
I don't personally have a problem with it, but had I maybe watched the show first and not known that, I might have felt different. I don't really know. It does situate the whole idea that this is a different type of Twilight Zone. And I've talked about the 80s, if you listen to our Blob episode of Double Features on Patreon, you didn't have a lot of really nuanced horror. The creature feature was on the way out in the 80s. It was slashers. What I love about this is that it was a monster movie, an old school type of film in a slasher decade.
One of the really interesting things about this film is that you can tell just by watching it, even for the first time, that it's very much a product of its time. And I think that's a very stark contrast to the series, because obviously the series isn't a product of its time because it's been remade so many times and it's still so relevant. But this could only have been made in the 1980s. And that's something that you could also love about it as well as hate about it.
And you can really tell, too, this is a passion project for a lot of them. Spielberg was really, really involved in this movie to the point that there are conspiracy theories about his involvement in this film and how deep that went. But Spielberg really spearheaded this. Spielberg is the one that got everybody together for this movie. When it failed horribly because of what had happened, he disassociated himself from it completely, and I think that really hurt him.
He even broke off his friendship with John Landis as a result of his negligence.
Yeah, they are not friends anymore. I get asked by people, because I've talked about what has happened on this set of this movie to people before, and I get asked all the time, like, I've seen John Landis. I've been near him at film festivals, and people have been like, would you ever interview him? I'm like, nope. It's just a personal thing. But we got to talk about why John Landis is no longer friends with Steven Spielberg. So the first proper episode of the movie is an episode called Time Out. It's the only original story in this one. Everything else is an adaptation of actual episodes. So they use the opening from this episode's What You Need and A Nice Place to Visit, but for the most part, this is an original one conceived by John Landis, who also directed the prologue. It tells the story of Bill Connor, played by Vic Morrow, who ages very well, oddly enough, who is a devout racist, who is complaining about how his Jewish coworker has taken a promotion that was rightfully his, even though his coworker had been working there longer. He's drinking in a bar and is talking to his friends using every slur about people who are Jewish, African Americans, Asians, to the point that he almost gets into a fight with some black patrons sitting nearby. He goes outside of the bar and finds himself in Nazi-occupied France during World War II, where he is chased by SS officers who believe he is Jewish. He can't convince them that he's an American, because what they see, you're supposed to believe, is somebody that looks Jewish, even though you're not really sure what that is. That's the point. He then ends up, as he's running, ends up in the South in the 50s with a bunch of Ku Klux Klansmen who believe that he's an African-American, that they're going to lynch. It doesn't matter that he tells them that he's white. Then he jumps into a lake and pops up in a jungle during the Vietnam War, where he's fired at by American soldiers who believe that he's Viet Cong. And then he is captured by the SS and put into a freight car along with a bunch of other Jewish prisoners going to a concentration camp. As he pleads for his friends to see him because he can see the bar at that point, they can't see him and the train pulls away. It ends on a very dour note. We're going to talk about why it ends that way in a second, but I want to talk about the vignette as is first. A lot of these episodes are very pat. it's the 80s. So there's not a whole lot of depth here. So the whole takeaway is racist gets his comeuppance by proving that there is no real distinction other than the ones that we create. So we don't know what the Ku Klux Klansmen see other than they see a black man. We don't know what the American soldiers see other than they see somebody that is obviously Vietnamese. So it's taking that Rod Serling interest in the aesthetics that we saw with something like The Eye of the Beholder and putting them into a racial conceit, which is really interesting. I like that it ends on a downer note, because I think to have it end with him being redeemed, which is how it was supposed to end, would have been very pat in 2018. Unfortunately, this has only aged better. Redeeming him at the end would have just been so simplistic. You know,
right.
He does a good deed. He's the white guy. He saves the day and he's no longer a racist. That's not how things work. So I like that it ends dour. Vic Morrow is brilliant in this. From what I had heard before this, he was difficult to work with. It's probably the most cynical of the whole movie. Mm-hmm. What do you think about the short as is?
Well, I'll start off by saying I had never seen anything of Vic Morrow's before this, but I thought that he was very convincing as a bigot and a very interesting portrayal. And honestly, I love that it dives a little bit deeper than just the statement that everybody makes today. Oh, today's bigots are just like Nazis argument. It takes it deeper, takes the audience through the history of hatred and wrong beliefs, shows multiple instances of this occurring in history. To be honest, I don't like the original ending. And I don't like this one as much. I like this ending more than what they had originally planned, but I would have preferred something like the classic Twilight Zone episodes where it's all an illusion or a dream, and he could have gone back into the bar with a different outlook on life and his behavior, and it would have been typical, but better than those two options and truer to the original show's style. I think the unpredictability of this, the fact that it was an original episode, really set me off balance for the rest of the movie. Even with the remakes of earlier episodes, I still didn't know what to expect because of the outcome of this segment.
I should have mentioned, I mean, this is, I guess, based in part on an episode in season 3 called Equality of Mercy. It's not completely based on that, but it is for the most part. Definitely think that there's something really bleak about this episode. And I think it's only bleaker based on what we know. So the episode was supposed to end with Bill returning to his own time. He saved the lives of these two Vietnamese children during a helicopter raid on their village. And that was going to be the happy ending that was going to lead into a second segment that was completely different, that was not going to be what it was. And we have to talk about the Twilight Zone accident. So July 23rd, 1982, they were filming a scene, the helicopter raid. The helicopter was going to come down over a village that they were filming on a set. So they had a closed set, real thatch roofs, village houses that they had built that were not flame retardant. They had a live helicopter filming overhead. They had two underage children, child actors, filming outside of the California labor laws who were not supposed to be there, who should not have been filming. John Landis hired these two child actors, Micah Dinley and Renee Shin-Yi Chen, 7 and 6 years old, without the required permits. They also had a bunch of people kind of violating labor laws. It wasn't really to them violating, it was just frowned upon. The kids were being paid under the table because the kids weren't allowed to be working at night. And he did not want to seek a waiver because he didn't think he would get permission. They were filming, I think, at like 1 or 2 in the morning. And he'd never get approval to have children around a lot of explosives. Supposedly, the casting agents were unaware that there were going to be kids in this scene. They were told that there was going to be stunt doubles. You usually had like either forced perspective or you got stunt people to do scenes like that. They told the child's parents not to tell any firefighters on the set that the children were there and to hide them from any welfare workers or fire safety officers that showed up. John Landis was told repeatedly by fire safety officials that you at thatch roofs, you have no flame retardant, you have a helicopter flying incredibly low, do not put off any explosives. There will be a crash. There will be something really bad. Allegedly, John Landis wanted bigger. He wanted better. He had had a lot of success previously and didn't really care what went on. Vic Morrow's character was supposed to carry the kids across the river while being pursued by this helicopter. And during filming, the helicopter was merely 25 feet from the ground, hovering near a mortar effect. The helicopter turned 180 degrees for the camera shot. The effect was detonated while the helicopter was above it, which caused the rotor to detach and fall from the plane. Helicopter fell out of control, fell on Vic Morrow, fell on the two children. All three of them died. There was a huge trial. The FAA came in. Essentially, everybody felt Landis was the one that should have overseen all of it. Everybody went on trial and nothing really happened. Everybody was acquitted. John Landis's career was not affected. He maintains that the special effects people, the helicopter pilot, should have been the one to figure out what was going to go on. There are conspiracy theories. There are a mountain of conspiracy theories that say Steven Spielberg was there and he was secreted out of the area because they didn't want any blowback on him. But really, nothing particularly terrible happened to anybody that I would say should have gotten in trouble for it. Mind you, three people died because of somebody feeling that they should all be there at 2 a.m. My own personal feelings aside, it was a very tragic event. It threatened to derail the movie. Steven Spielberg was supposed to do The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, but he did not want to do something so dark to follow that up, and so did what ended up being the second sequence of the film, which is Kick the Can. It was a horrible, horrible series of events. Everybody was found not guilty, but it did force more strict stunt laws and rules with explosives in Hollywood. I think they said that it was the worst on-set accident up until a more recent accident a couple years ago. It's a horrific series of events. If you want to read more than just my recollection of what happened, go read the book Outrageous Conduct. It's a fantastic book that lays out everything. But it really colors the rest of the movie once you know what has happened. You mentioned knowing the story more than the movie first. Samantha, what are your thoughts on the whole thing?
You really summed up the events very well. There's not a whole lot that you can really say, especially because, like you mentioned, no one got punished for something like this. It was horribly negligent, especially of John Landis. The child actors were paid under the table because they knew that they would never get permission to do anything like this. It's just terrible to think about.
You really can't. I mean, there's really no kind transition at that point. And again, they thought about shelving the movie entirely. They didn't because there had already been so much money invested in it, and the other two directors had already been, I believe, filmed their parts. So they had a pretty much assembled movie at that point that they had to release and try to recoup some money on at that point. But that segues us to Kick the Can, which I consider the worst part of the movie.
I would absolutely agree with that.
Again, this was more a matter of convenience to try to make lemons out of lemonade. Steven Spielberg wanted to do Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, which, if anybody has seen that episode, is a communist allegory about an experiment on a small town where the lights go out, everybody starts to wonder and question their neighbors about, you did it, you made this happen. It's a really interesting allegory for our penchant to blame something, others, when something goes wrong. Of course, Spielberg thought it was a little too dour. I'd also say it hits a little too close to home, considering the concept of blame. But he decided to do a remake, Kick the Can, about an old man named Mr. Bloom, played by Scatman Crothers, who's moved into the Sunnyvale retirement home, where all the people are old and sad. And he tells them that they can feel young again by playing a game of Kick the Can. They decide to go out, and by playing this game, they literally turn into young versions of themselves. While the old people are very happy to play and be young again, they realize that they are going to have to deal with the fact that their loved ones are going to die, that there's no one to take care of them, that their loved ones that they may have married that have passed away no longer exist. And so they all decide to return back to their adult bodies, quote, with fresh young minds. This movie can be blamed firmly on Cocoon. This segment, at least. Cocoon came out in 85. So technically came out after this, but I blame Cocoon for this regardless. The concept of like lovable old people learning about the joys of being elderly. It's a very sweet short. It's an incredibly sappy short. I would say it's a little too sweet and simplistic for the Twilight Zone.
Right.
I've never seen the original Kick the Can, so I don't know how it necessarily went. And I have a lot of issues with Scatman Crothers. I love him, but I feel he's playing the mystical Negro trope. Which, if you know, don't know what that is, that's having a person of color essentially there to reinvigorate white people by being quirky and magical. And that's essentially what he is. I don't care for this one. I really just tune out and wait for the other two when this one plays. What do you think about this one?
I would completely agree. I find it really crazy that the most well-known of the directors in this film directed the most boring segment. Like, he had so much to do with production, but then this is the result? It's a little surprising. I mean, it's a cute concept. The original was too, but everybody who is a fan of the original series understands that the Kick the Can episode is essentially a throwaway. I mean, it's pretty boring. The kids are adorable. I love the young Mrs. Dempsey with her glasses and her missing tooth and her cat. And I love seeing Scatman Crothers in this. I do enjoy his work. Of course, he's best known for The Shining. And I liked him in The Aristocats. And he's really the glue that holds the segment together. Aside from that, there's just not much going on here. And I agree with you. If I watched this again, I would fast forward it.
I really wish he had done Monsters or Do on Maple Street. I understand why he didn't. It's, again, another nighttime episode that would have had children and special effects. But this feels like Spielberg. I'm going to say it. This feels like Spielberg now, where it's just really safe and really treacly. And I don't really care about it. I literally don't have anything to say about it. I do find the old people to be adorable. Right. Mrs. Dempsey. Helen Shaw is also played the grandma in Parenthood, so I think she's really adorable here. I do also like Selma Diamond, who plays Mrs. Weinstein. I especially like her younger counterpart, who sounds like she's from New York.
Right, that was hilarious.
She has that really heavy accent. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I will say I do like Mr. Agee, who is the older, more debonair character who wants to be, he said when he was young, he wanted to be Douglas Fairbanks, and he essentially is transformed into a horny 13-year-old boy. I thought that was cute. The acting is good. I don't have a problem with the acting. I think the story, though, is just bland.
It just wasn't necessary to include in this film, I think.
I feel like Spielberg needed to have something to explain his contributions, but this one just could have. I mean, I guess it's great that it's in the middle, so you can just kind of zone out. You wanted to bring up Monsters or Do on Maple Street.
Like you mentioned, I would have much preferred that. I think another point regarding that one in relation to the rest of the film is I think that it would have been great to include because of the strong political message that Time Out had. Those are two very on-the-nose political messages, and Monsters or Do on Maple Street is universally regarded as the most plain and obvious political allegory that he created for the show. So I think it would have been perfect to follow Time Out. I agree with you. I really wish he had, because that's a fantastic episode. I think I'm surprised we didn't even include it in the first talking about the episodes, because it's great.
Go watch it. It's fantastic. Do not watch the Kick the Can.
Yeah, don't watch that one. You can skip that one.
The third segment is a remake of It's a Good Life. This one's directed by Gremlins director Joe Dante. If you haven't seen the original short, It's a Good Life, it stars Bill Mumy from Lost in Space as a little boy named Anthony who can make anything happen. He can wish for anything, but anybody who crosses him gets sent to the cornfield. I love the original It's a Good Life. I literally, anytime something bad happens, I will look at my mom or whoever and be like, don't make any noise when the music's playing. Which, if you've seen the episode, he doesn't like people to play music when he's doing something. He doesn't like Perry Como. He doesn't like a lot of things. I love that it's little Bill Mummy doing all of this. But they remade it here with Kathleen Quinlan, who plays Helen Foley, which is actually the name of a character from another episode called Nightmare as a Child. And the opening narration is from a different episode called Night Call, which is really weird. But Helen Foley is traveling to a new job. She seems adrift, doesn't have a whole lot going on in her life, stops at a bar for directions, and she meets Anthony, a little boy played by Jeremy Litch, who is playing video games, ends up irritating some of the local patrons, one of whom is played by an adult Bill Mummy. I've seen this movie a lot, and I just noticed that, I think, like, a couple years ago, that it was Bill Mummy. But Helen comes to his defense. She tries to leave the bar and ends up hitting Anthony with her car, damaging his bike, so she offers to take him home to his house, which is a replica of a house from a show called Mouse Wreckers. I did not know that until today. And she meets Anthony's family. So he has an Uncle Walt, played by Invasion of the Body Snatchers actor Kevin McCarthy. His mother and his father, his dad's played by William Shaller, which I think is really cool. And his sister Ethel, who is played by Nancy Cartwright from The Simpsons. If you listen to her voice, you'll understand. If you listen to her voice, you'll know it's Bart Simpson.
I have to mention, too, I was so thrilled to see Patricia Barry play his mother. She, to me, as far as the cameos from the original show, I think that was my favorite, second only to Burgess Meredith. She was in, I believe, 2 episodes of the original series, but she was in a favorite of mine called The Chaser, in which her character is given a love potion by George Grizzard.
I did not know
right.
that.
And she just gave a fantastic performance on the show. And as soon as I saw her in the movie, I instantly recognized her because she was so beautiful. Like, I was instantly taken by her beauty in the original series. And it was just so great to have a little nod to her in this.
She plays the Daffy mom in this, who is trying to save the goldfish. Anthony's family is eerily afraid of him. Helen goes to use the bathroom and they immediately start like rummaging through her stuff. Helen meets his other sister, who you find out has no mouth, which is literally one of the most frightening things I remember seeing from this movie. And you eventually find out that Anthony can control everything with his mind. He can send people away. He can take away their mouths so they can't yell at him. He can make the food however he wants. So they're eating hamburgers with peanut butter on them and candied apples for dinner. And of course, Helen tries to leave and she can't up until the ending. This is an interesting, I'm not going to say improvement, alternative, because the movie is really interested in not just retelling these stories, but trying to tell them in a different way. So It's a Good Life, the original short, is more about the capriciousness of being a child, watching these adults try their hardest to not upset him. When that episode came out, it was also around the same time as the original Village of the Damned, which was also about supernaturally controlling children. And I don't really know what that meant culturally, like why that was a thing, but it was around the same time. Here, Anthony's a little older, you know, he's about 10, 11. So there's not that cuteness factor to him. There's not that unknowing capriciousness about it. This isn't a kid that doesn't really know what he's doing. This is a kid that knows what he's doing. And he's very manipulative and very scheming. Joe Dante is a real great master of making the silly with the macabre. If you've seen Gremlins, then you know that a lot of what makes Gremlins unique is how silly it is, but also how frightening. I mean, geez, there's a whole third act about Phoebe Cates' dad dying in the fireplace during Christmas, and they didn't find him for 6 months. Whereas here, it's showing how I find old cartoons to be very frightening. And I think this movie plays on that. The animated segment where he sends Ethel into the cartoon just terrifies me. It still creeps me out as an adult. Just showing that emphasis of how old cartoons tended to be very ghoulish. It leads to a lot of really great creature effects. Rick Bottin does some creature effects here that are very unsettling. The rabbit that Uncle Walt pulls out of the hat. I mean, none of this is cute. None of this is I mean, it's just weird and gross and odd. And I think it really works to show that you could do something different with these episodes. I do think it ends horribly, though. Helen wants to teach Anthony how to control his power because, you know, she's a young woman. She doesn't have anything going on. She's no husband, no kids. So let's just saddle her with a kid that can do horrible things. You know, she tames this wild child. Everything up to that point is really good.
I honestly think that this might be an unpopular opinion, but I'm just going to say it. I like this Anthony a lot more than the original Anthony. And that really, yeah, that really surprised me because, of course, the original is such a classic. But I think this Anthony is a lot more sympathetic to the point where you can almost understand his logic. He can manipulate his surroundings and create these things, and he doesn't really understand as much why people are afraid of him. He just wants a friend who isn't. And I love the subtlety and the gradual escalation of Anthony's villainy in this. He seems so harmless for much of the segment that I genuinely wondered if there would be any similarity to the original. In the original, the child is just plain villain. There's nothing really redeeming about him, and it's a lot more understandable that the adults are afraid of him in the show, I think. But in this, you know, he actually has possibly some redeemable qualities in there. It's great that there's a character who should definitely be afraid of him, but isn't. The ending, I don't think that it just sucks, but I do think it's very abrupt. It really makes you think about what happens to the two of them afterwards. Like, do they really stay together? Does he teach her how he manipulates his surroundings? Because it sounds like that's her main goal, that she wants to learn from him and teach him to calm down and in return. Is she even trying to use him? There are a lot of questions there.
The original It's a Good Life has Cloris Leachman. It's got some serious actors in it who are trying to be pleasant on the outside, control their thoughts on the inside. So there's this constant state of uptight quality to them. Like they're constantly tied together with some really tight string because they're so afraid that if Anthony catches a glimpse into their mind and sees that they're thinking something bad about him, that something bad's going to happen. Here, what I love about William Shatner and Patricia Barry and Kevin McCarthy and Nancy Cartwright, you're led to believe that these are all random people that he has just picked up throughout his life because he doesn't have his real mother and father because Ethel says they made him mad. And maybe one day he'll do to you what he did to them. And I did not notice that his sister Sarah, who cannot talk, is Cherie Currie from The Runaways. Wow. Did not know that either. You're led to believe that he's pasted together this family, in this version at least, because in the original, they're his biological parents. Here, these people are just hungry for communication with somebody else. So when she shows up, they send her out to the bathroom and they, again, start ripping her stuff apart. The ones, yeah, Ethel's smoking her cigarettes, the ones wearing her sweater, the other, they're all looking at her pictures. They are just so desperate for outside communication with somebody. They are willing to just sacrifice her to him if it means that they can get some peace. And even though you believe that they've been there for a long time, there is still this walking on eggshells. You know, the mother asks Anthony, where's dinner? And he says, isn't it where it always is in the kitchen? They're on edge, but it's a different type of edge that's almost on the level of like madness.
On the show, the family is so much more put together. They've been there for a long time. They know exactly how to act around Anthony. You can tell that nothing bad has happened to these people in a long time. Someone was sent to the cornfield a long time ago. But in this family, in this pasted together family in the film, there's always someone saying the wrong thing. I feel like they're a little more loose. Especially the fake sister isn't afraid to say how she feels.
poor Ethel is just sacrificed again by the other family members in a way that's almost kind of reminiscent of The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, where there's a note that is slipped to Helen that says, you know, Anthony's awful, help us. And everybody immediately says, Ethel, it was Ethel, right. She did it. And I love how they immediately turn on her. I also give Kevin McCarthy, he gets an MVP nod here for playing the sweaty Uncle Walt, who is just constantly afraid, just wants to sit in his chair and has to pull horrible things out of his hat that Anthony keeps coming up with. The cartoonishness of this is so frightening and so grim, but I appreciate all of it.
There are a lot of changes, but they're welcome changes. This was definitely in the better half of the segments of this film for me.
Well, then we transition to another remake of a classic, the remake of Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. This is directed by George Miller, who did Mad Max. He also did Happy Feet, in case you want a 360 right there. If you have seen the original Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, it stars William Shatner as a man who is on a plane. This is an episode written by Richard Matheson, and he sees what is supposed to be a weird gremlin, but it just looks like a snowman on the wing of a plane. I mean, he's just like a furry, like, sheep snowman guy on the wing of the plane who is messing with it. If you've seen Saturday Night Live spoofed this with Jude Law once, and it was just making fun of how silly the original thing looks. What George Miller does is, I think, something that the It's a Good Life short does too, which is up the tension. So you have John Lithgow, who plays a writer named John Valentine, who already does not like to fly. He's having a panic attack because he does not like to fly. It's a rough, turbulent flight. He's finally calmed down enough to sit and looks outside and sees a gremlin. And we're not talking cute, cuddly sheep guy in a fuzzy suit. We're talking frightening hell spawn on the wing of this airplane that is trying to down the plane. You find out he's looking at the newspaper and it's like, horrible air accident, cause unknown. And you're supposed to believe that this is something that is happening frequently. The gremlin is ripping out the wires and trying to damage the engine. And every time Valentine looks outside, he sees it. And at one point, the gremlin just starts screwing with him and like looks at him and does all sorts of stuff. Of course, John can't get anybody to believe him, and it culminates with him trying to shoot out the window, shoot the gremlin, which of course causes the gremlin to run up to him and grab his face and scold him. He wags his finger in his face and then leaps off into the sky, and the airplane makes an emergency landing, and Valentine is carted off as insane, but the maintenance crew comes and finds damage to the engine, complete with claw marks. This is another improvement, not nearly as much of an improvement, I think, as the It's a Good Life, but I do think that this is a good one. I hate to fly. And I think that this is one that is responsible for that a little bit, not completely, but the gremlin is incredibly terrifying in this short. He's slimy. He looks like the Predator, only more frightening. Not only does it make the gremlin frightening, but the rest of the people on the plane have this really weird over-exaggeration to them. The little girl that is sitting there taking pictures with the weird Howdy Doody doll that she's just like constantly playing around with. The fact that there's other people on this plane that just treat him with disdain and ignore him. The only person that is nice to him is the flight attendant, who keeps trying to get him to take these sedatives that she has, and he won't do it. This is all about John Lithgow. Where Shatner was always very calm, even though when he's trying to play the character as freaking out, he's still got that Shatneriness to him. John Lithgow goes for broke. He's sweating. He's pale. I mean, he is definitely having a moment. And it has nothing to do with the gremlin. I think that's what makes it so relatable, is that the gremlin is just one thing that is a real fear. We all get told this, but it doesn't help. The irrational fear that nothing, you know, that turbulence doesn't take down a plane. But he already is just consumed by that. And I think that's what makes this short work. What do you think about this one and the original?
This is without a doubt my favorite of the segments in the movie. at first, I thought that it was just funny and ridiculous. John's acting was pretty over the top from the beginning and all of the special effects. You say the gremlin is terrifying, but it just reminded me a lot of Beetlejuice's special effects.
7-year-old me still talking right here about, you know, I think it scared me more when I was a kid, and now that's just all residual.
Exactly. I literally recall when I watched this for the first time, I was laughing, but slowly throughout this portion of the movie, I just put my hand on my chest and my heart was like racing. And I was so shocked that I was having this reaction. And as soon as he pulled out the gun, I really had no idea how this was going to end. And I was truly feeling every bit of the suspense and the terror. This is the first movie in a long time to make me feel genuinely scared, even though I wasn't scared of the look of the antagonist himself.
This movie could have maybe played on the ambiguity a bit more. The fact that he's already frightened of flying, that's what makes the short work so well, which is that everybody naturally assumes that he's just nervous because of the airplane. They already might have to make an emergency landing because the engine is down. And I think that's what makes it work. The movie doesn't necessarily play with, is he seeing this or not? It's pretty evident that it's there. Right. And I don't necessarily know how they could have played that up anymore, but I wish they had a little bit.
I honestly wish that his performance would have been a little more subdued. I'm kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum. At the end, though, we can both agree that it was totally convincing and understandable.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's great. And it leads to the closing of the film. John Valentine's strapped to this gurney. He's going to go to an insane asylum. And the driver of the ambulance is Dan Aykroyd. He turns around. He says, "Heard you had a big scare up there." He's playing the Midnight Special, which is the opening of the movie, the song. And he says, "Want to see something really scary?" And that's how the movie ends, with Rod Serling doing the opening narration from the show. I don't know why we waited till the end to play Rod's voice. It would have been nice to have that in the beginning instead of the end, but whatever. It's hard to really top that opening, but I do like that we get Dan Aykroyd back again, although... Poor John Lithgow.
I was going to say, I actually dislike that last part with Dan Aykroyd. I understand the need to add part of the prologue to tie the whole movie together, but it was just too cheesy considering how invested I got in his situation and the horrific ordeal that he'd just gone through. It didn't fit.
Again, I don't really know how you could have ended
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
Well, here's an ending that I think would have worked. You have the reveal of the massacred engine, and then just play the Rod Serling.
That's how I would have ended it, too. That's exactly what I would have done. I don't see the need to put Rod Serling in just as a little blurb at the end. If you weren't going to include him in any other portion, I think that was a little strange. I'm glad that they did include him. I just wish that they had included him more if they were going to do that in the first place.
I don't really know why this desire to distance themselves from the Rod Serling elements. I know that Carol Serling had cooperated with them, and I don't know if necessarily after the events of what happened, if she tried to distance herself or if it's completely irrelevant. They might have just decided they always wanted to go with Rod Serling at the end. But I wish we had more Rod Serling, because you don't have Twilight Zone without Rod Serling. The movie, in case anybody is curious, it's celebrating its 35th anniversary this year. It came out in June, and it got really mixed reviews. The trial ended up going on for a decade after the movie opened. It didn't really resolve itself until the early 90s.
If you could call it a resolution.
Roger Ebert rated every segment individually. He gave 2 stars for the prologue in the first segment, 1.5 stars for the Kick the Can, 3.5 for It's a Good Life, and 3.5 for The Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, which that sounds about right. Modern day reception to this is still very mixed. It has a 61% on Rotten Tomatoes. The critical consensus is that it has highs and lows, and the former outnumber the latter. It did open number 4 the weekend it came out, June 24th of 83, grossed about $6 million, which is about $5,000 per theater. It's technically about $15 million in 2009 dollars. This is with a limited release. It did not open wide. It cost $10 million to make, so it wasn't a huge hit that the executives were kind of looking for, but it still made money. And it did compel CBS to do a short-lived 1980s TV version of The Twilight Zone. I enjoy this movie a lot. I think it's a very underrated film that is hampered by a very tragic set of circumstances. If you watch it knowing all of that, I still think you can derive something enjoyable from it. As we've already documented, some very big highs and lows. I would say that the prologue is fantastic. Time Out, it's a very tragic novelty to watch. Kick the Can, I'm going to say, sucks. And It's a Good Life and Nightmare 20,000 Feet are the best. It gets maligned unfairly. And the fact that the 35th anniversary just kind of came and went is very sad. I've talked to Joe Dante, and I'm very upset that I did not ask him about this movie. Although, to be fair, I get the sneaking suspicion that none of the directors want to talk about this movie. So,
that's fair.
Samantha, what are your overall thoughts?
I would agree with you on all points. I think that it had its ups and downs. The film version does the original series justice as only the 80s could have. Like I mentioned before, it's very much a product of its time. I'm really astonished that the two parts that I enjoyed the most, It's a Good Life and Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, were the two directed by people that I wasn't aware of before this. I still have a lot to learn about modern cinema. As we mentioned before, I would have had Spielberg direct The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. I think that would have improved the film immensely. I would have removed the very end. And other than that, I think that it would be a solid favorite for the decade. Though that's not saying a whole lot because, like I said, I still have a lot to learn with the 80s movies.
This is an anomaly in the 80s, I will tell you. Not a whole lot of Twilight Zone-esque films to be found in the 80s. Listeners, if you want to share your thoughts, you can send me your thoughts on the Twilight Zone movie, about how I'm wrong about Kick the Can, how you don't think John Landis is a murderer, all of that. You can email me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com. If you're John Landis's attorney, I say this all in jest, please do not sue me. And I'll read them on the next episode. I'd like to thank once again Samantha Ellis for hanging out and talking about the Twilight Zone. Samantha, where can fans find to get in touch with you?
Well, thank you very much. I can be found on my new Twitter at Classic Film Geek. And of course, my blog, musingsofaclassicfilmaddict.wordpress.com. And I'm on Tumblr at annsblythe.tumblr.com.
Well, that's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. As always, you can listen to Ticklish Business a variety of different ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, Player FM, Spotify, or iTunes. If you're listening via iTunes, please consider helping the podcast out with a rating and review. You can always contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. And the podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Want to learn more about upcoming episodes? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks. I'm actually going to start streamlining some of the tiers to give new and existing patrons more bang for their buck. So all of your donations go right back into making the podcast as awesome as it is and improving upon it. And if you become a patron right now, you can listen to episodes for my two new supplementary shows. William Bibbiani and I look at how Hollywood talks about itself in cinema, with the show based on a true podcast. In honor of Halloween, we're looking at the 2000 feature Shadow of the Vampire, which posits that maybe Nosferatu was a snuff film.